Chapter 55. Readily arrive in the hands of His Grace the Duke of Marlborough, who surely would wish to do justice to every officer of his army. Mr. Webb knows his duty too well to think of insubordination to his superior officer, or of using his sword in a campaign against any but the enemies of Her Majesty. He solicits permission to return to England immediately the military duties will permit, and take with him to England Captain Esmond, of his regiment, who acted as his aide-de-camp, and was present during the entire action, and noted by his watch the time when Mr. Cadogan arrived at its close. The commander-in-chief could not but grant this permission, nor could he take notice of Webb's letter, though it was couched in terms the most insulting. Half the army believed that the cities of Ghent and Bruges were given up by a treason, which some in our army very well understood. That the commander-in-chief would not have relieved Lille if he could have helped himself, that he would not have fought that year had not the Prince of Savoy forced him. When the battle once began, then, for his own renown, my Lord Marlborough would fight as no man in the world ever fought better, and no bribe on earth could keep him from beating the enemy. *. Our grandfather's hatred of the Duke of Marlborough appears all through his account of these campaigns. He always persisted that the Duke was the greatest traitor and soldier history ever told of, and declared that he took bribes on all hands during the war. My Lord Marquis, for so we may call him here, though he never went by any other name than Colonel Esmond, was in the habit of telling many stories which he did not set down in his memoirs, and which he had from his friend the Jesuit, who was not always correctly informed, and who persisted that Marlborough was looking for a bribe of 2 millions of crowns before the campaign of Ramillies. And our grandmother used to tell us children that on his first presentation to my Lord Duke, the Duke turned his back upon my grandfather, and said to the Duchess, who told my Lady Dowager at Chelsea, who afterwards told Colonel Esmond, "Ah, Esmond's bastard has been to my levee. He has the hangdog look of his rogue of a father," an expression which my grandfather never forgave. He was as constant in his dislikes as in his attachments, and exceedingly partial to Webb, whose side he took against the more celebrated general. We have General Webb's portrait now at Castlewood, Virginia, but the matter was taken up by the subordinates, and half the army might have been by the ears, if the quarrel had not been stopped. General Cadogan sent an intimation to General Webb to say that he was ready if Webb liked, and would meet him. This was a kind of invitation our stout old general was always too ready to accept, and 'twas with great difficulty we got the general to reply that he had no quarrel with Mr. Cadogan, who had behaved with perfect gallantry, but only with those at headquarters, who had belied him. Mr. Cardonnel offered General Webb reparation. Mr. Webb said he had a cane at the service of Mr. Cardonnel, and the only satisfaction he wanted from him was one he was not likely to get, namely, the truth. The officers in our staff of Webb's, and those in the immediate suite of the general, were ready to come to blows, and hence arose the only affair in which Mr. Esmond ever engaged as principal, and that was from a revengeful wish to wipe off an old injury. My Lord Mohun, who had a troop in Lord Macclesfield's regiment of the Horse Guards, rode this campaign with the Duke. He had sunk by this time to the very worst reputation. He had had another fatal duel in Spain. He had married and forsaken his wife. He was a gambler, a profligate, and debauchee. He joined just before Oudenard, and, as Esmond feared, as soon as Frank Castlewood heard of his arrival, Frank was for seeking him out and killing him. The wound my lord got at Oudenard prevented their meeting, but that was nearly healed, and Mr. Esmond trembled daily lest any chance should bring his boy and this known assassin together. They met at the mess table of Handyside's regiment at Lille, the officer commanding not knowing of the feud between the two noblemen. Esmond had not seen the hateful handsome face of Mohun for 9 years, since they had met on that fatal night in Leicester Field. It was degraded with crime and passion now. It wore the anxious look of a man who has three deaths, and who knows how many hidden shames, and lusts, and crimes on his conscience. He bowed with a sickly low bow, and slunk away when our host presented us round to one another. Frank Castlewood had not known him till then, so changed was he. He knew the boy well enough. 'Twas curious to look at the two, especially the young man, whose face flushed up when he heard the hated name of the other, and who said in his bad French, and his brave boyish voice, he had long been anxious to meet my Lord Mohun. The other only bowed, and moved away from him. I do him justice, he wished to have no quarrel with the lad. Esmond put himself between them at table. "It," says Frank, "why do you put yourself in the place of a man who is above you in degree? My Lord Mohun should walk after me. I want to sit by my Lord Mohun." Esmond whispered to Lord Mohun that Frank was hurt in the leg at Oudenard, and besought the other to be quiet. Quiet enough he was for some time, disregarding the many taunts which young Castlewood flung at him, until after several healths, when my Lord Mohun got to be rather in liquor. "Will you go away, my lord?" Mr. Esmond said to him, imploring him to quit the table. "No, by G," says my Lord Mohun. "I'll not go away for any man." He was quite flushed with wine by this time. The talk got round to the affairs of yesterday. Webb had offered to challenge the commander-in-chief. Webb had been ill-used. Webb was the bravest, handsomest, vainest man in the army. Lord Mohun did not know that Esmond was Webb's aide-de-camp. He began to tell some stories against the general, which, from t'other side of Esmond, young Castlewood contradicted. "I can't bear any more of this," says my Lord Mohun. "Nor can I, my lord," says Mr. Esmond, starting up. "His story my Lord Mohun has told respecting General Webb is false, gentlemen false, I repeat," and making a low bow to Lord Mohun, and without a single word more, Esmond got up and left the dining room. These affairs were common enough among the military of those days. There was a garden behind the house, and all the party turned instantly into it, and the two gentlemen's coats were off, and their points engaged within 2 minutes after Esmond's words had been spoken. If Captain Esmond had put Mohun out of the world, as he might, a villain would have been punished and spared further villainies, but who is one man to punish another? I declare upon my honor that my only thought was to prevent Lord Mohun from mischief with Frank, and the end of this meeting was that after half a dozen passes my lord went home with a hurt which prevented him from lifting his right arm for 3 months. "Oh, Harry, why didn't you kill the villain?" young Castlewood asked. "Can't walk without a crutch. But I could have met him on horseback with sword and pistol." But Harry Esmond said, "'Twas best to have no man's life on one's conscience, not even that villain's." And this affair, which did not occupy 3 minutes, being over, the gentlemen went back to their wine, and my Lord Mohun to his quarters, where he was laid up with a fever which had spared mischief had it proved fatal. And very soon after this affair Harry Esmond and his general left the camp for London, whither a certain reputation had preceded the captain, for my Lady Castlewood of Chelsea received him as if he had been a conquering hero. She gave a great dinner to Mr. Webb, where the general's chair was crowned with laurels, and her ladyship called Esmond's health in a toast, to which my kind general was graciously pleased to bear the strongest testimony, and took down a mob of at least 40 coaches to cheer our general as he came out of the House of Commons, the day when he received the thanks of Parliament for his action. The mob huzzaed and applauded him, as well as the fine company. It was splendid to see him waving his hat, and bowing, and laying his hand upon his order of generosity. He introduced Mr. Esmond to Mr. St. John, and the Right Honorable Robert Harley Esquire, as he came out of the house walking between them, and was pleased to make many flattering observations regarding Mr. Esmond's behavior during the three last campaigns. Mr. St. John, who had the most winning presence of any man I ever saw, except in all was my peerless young Frank Castlewood, said he had heard of Mr. Esmond before from Captain Steele, and how he had helped Mr. Addison to write his famous poem of the campaign. 'Twas as great an achievement as the victory of Blenheim itself, Mr. Harley said, who was famous as a judge and patron of letters. And so, perhaps, it may be, though for my part I think there are 20 beautiful lines, but all the rest is commonplace, and Mr. Addison's hymn worth 1,000 such poems. All the town was indignant at my Lord Duke's unjust treatment of General Webb, and applauded the vote of thanks which the House of Commons gave to the general for his victory at Winnendall. 'Tis certain that the capture of Lille was the consequence of that lucky achievement, and the humiliation of the old French king, who was said to suffer more at the loss of this great city than from any of the former victories our troops had won over him. And, I think, no small part of Mr. Webb's exultation at his victory arose from the idea that Marlborough had been disappointed of a great bribe the French king had promised him, should the siege be raised. The very sum of money offered to him was mentioned by the Duke's enemies, and honest Mr. Webb chuckled at the notion, not only of beating the French, but of beating Marlborough too, and intercepting a convoy of 3 millions of French crowns that were on their way to the Generalissimo's insatiable pockets. When the general's lady went to the Queen's drawing room, all the Tory women crowded round her with congratulations, and made her a train greater than the Duchess of Marlborough's own. Feasts were given to the general by all the chiefs of the Tory party, who vaunted him as the Duke's equal in military skill, and perhaps used the worthy soldier as their instrument, whilst he thought they were but acknowledging his merits as a commander. As the general's aide-de-camp and favorite officer, Mr. Esmond came in for a share of his chief's popularity, and was presented to Her Majesty, and advanced to the rank of lieutenant colonel, at the request of his grateful chief. We may be sure there was one family in which any good fortune that happened to Esmond caused such a sincere pride and pleasure, that he, for his part, was thankful he could make them so happy. With these fond friends, Blenheim and Oudenaarde seemed to be mere trifling incidents of the war, and Winnendall was its crowning victory. Esmond's mistress never tired to hear accounts of the battle, and I think General Webb's lady grew jealous of her, for the general was forever at Kensington, and talking on that delightful theme. As for his aide-de-camp, though, no doubt, Esmond's own natural vanity was pleased at the little share of reputation which his good fortune had won him, yet it was chiefly precious to him, he may say so, now that he hath long since outlived it, because it pleased his mistress, and, above all, because Beatrix valued it. As for the old dowager of Chelsea, never was an old woman in all England more delighted nor more gracious than she. Esmond had his quarters in her ladyship's house, where the domestics were instructed to consider him as their master. She bade him give entertainments, of which she defrayed the charges, and was charmed when his guests were carried away tipsy in their coaches. She must have his picture taken, and accordingly he was painted by Mr. Jervis, in his red coat, and smiling upon a bombshell, which was bursting at the corner of the piece. She vowed that, unless he made a great match, she should never die easy, and was forever bringing young ladies to Chelsea, with pretty faces and pretty fortunes, at the disposal of the colonel. He smiled to think how times were altered with him, and of the early days, in his father's lifetime, when a trembling page he stood before her, with her ladyship's basin and ewer, or crouched in her coach step. The only fault she found with him was, that he was more sober than an Esmond ought to be, and would neither be carried to bed by his valet, nor lose his heart to any beauty, whether of St. James or Covent Garden. What is the meaning of fidelity in love, and whence the birth of it? 'Tis a state of mind, that men fall into, and depending on the man, rather than the woman. We love being in love, that's the truth on't. If we had not met Joan, we should have met Kate, and adored her. We know our mistresses are no better than many other women, nor no prettier, nor no wiser, nor no wittier. 'Tis not for these reasons we love a woman, or for any special quality or charm I know of. We might as well demand that a lady should be the tallest woman in the world, like the Shropshire giantess, asterisk as that she should be a paragon in any other character, before we began to love her. Esmond's mistress had a thousand faults beside her charms. He knew both perfectly well. She was imperious, she was light-minded, she was flighty, she was false, as he had no reverence in her character. She was in everything, even in beauty, the contrast of her mother, who was the most devoted, and the least selfish of women. Well, from the very first moment he saw her on the stairs at Walcott, Esmond knew he loved Beatrix. There might be better women, he wanted that one. He cared for none other. Was it because she was gloriously beautiful? Beautiful as she was, he had heard people say a score of times in their company that Beatrix's mother looked as young, and was the handsomer of the two. Why did her voice thrill in his ear so? She could not sing near so well as Nicolini or Mrs. Tofts. Nay, she sang out of tune, and yet he liked to hear her better than St. Cecilia. As he had not a finer complexion than Mrs. Steele, Dick's wife, whom he had now got, and who ruled poor Dick with a rod of pickle, and yet to see her dazzle Desmond, he would shut his eyes, and the thought of her dazzled him all the same. She was brilliant and lively in talk, but not so incomparably witty as her mother, who, when she was cheerful, said the finest things, but yet to hear her, and to be with her, was Esmond's greatest pleasure. Days passed away between him and these ladies, he scarce knew how. He poured his heart out to them, so as he never could in any other company, where he hath generally passed for being moody, or supercilious and silent. This SOCIETY asterisk asterisk was more delightful than that of the greatest wits to him. May heaven pardon him the lies he told the Dowager at Chelsea, in order to get a pretext for going away to Kensington. The business at the ordnance which he invented, the interview with his general, the courts and statesmen's levies which he didn't frequent and describe, who wore a new suit on Sunday at St. James, or at the Queen's birthday, how many coaches filled the street at Mr. Harley's levee, how many bottles he had the honor to drink overnight with Mr. St. John at the Cocoa Tree, or at the Ardor with Mr. Walpole and Mr. Steele. Asterisk 'tis not thus woman loves. Colonel E. hath owned to this folly for a score of women besides. R. asterisk asterisk, and, indeed, so was his to them, a thousand times more charming, for where was his equal? R. Mistress Beatrix Esmond had been a dozen times on the point of making great matches, so the court scandal said. But for his part Esmond never would believe the stories against her, and came back, after 3 years' absence from her, not so frantic as he had been perhaps, but still hungering after her and no other, still hopeful, still kneeling, with his heart in his hand for the young lady to take. We were now got to 1709. She was near 22 years old, and 3 years at court, and without a husband. 'Tis not for want of being asked, Lady Castlewood said, looking into Esmond's heart, as she could, with that perceptiveness affection gives. But she will make no mean match, Harry. She will not marry as I would have her, the person whom I should like to call my son, and Henry Esmond knows who that is best served by my not pressing his claim. Beatrix is so willful, that what I would urge on her, she would be sure to resist. The man who would marry her, will not be happy with her, unless he be a great person, and can put her in a great position. Beatrix loves admiration more. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.